Welcome back to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. November can be an extraordinary month to spend quality time outside. I think we were reminded all of that over the weekend. One other reason to make plans to be outside this month. This month we will have what's called a super moon. And the bottom line there is, with a super moon, this means the moon will be the closest to the Earth that it's been since, get this, January 1948. This will happen on the evening of November 14th. The moon will appear up to 14% bigger, according to my sources here, and 30% brighter than an average full moon. And this is the closest the moon will get to the Earth until November 25th, 2034. So you really don't want to miss this one. The supermoon, the evening of November the 14th. After close to 2 years of campaigning, the 2016 election is tomorrow. Polls show Hillary Clinton is likely to carry Michigan over Donald Trump, and we'll find out tomorrow if they've been accurate. The polls have made us curious about how polling works. So Current State Scott Pohl talked with a leading Michigan pollster. Tell us about Richard Shuba, Scott.
Well, Mark, Richard Shuba does public polling for the Detroit News, and his lengthy and diverse resume includes time doing private polling for then-Governor John Engler. He tells me that the Detroit News has been polling the presidential race in Michigan for a long time, and despite the efforts of both campaigns, the numbers haven't moved much.
We've been polling this race in various forms since June of 2015, and the one thing we are seeing that is rock-solid consistent in every poll that we do is that Hillary Clinton is getting 42 or 43% of the vote. What we're seeing for the Republican, and once Donald Trump won the nomination in May, he was the person we were always testing. His numbers ranged from a low of 31, and that was the point where Clinton had an 11-point lead, to where we were in May, and now again, just about a 4.5-point lead, where he's at 38%. So when we polled in May, after the nominations were secured, we had Clinton at a 4.5% lead, and that's roughly where it appears to be again. We really haven't seen a lot of movement.
All of this coverage, and it hasn't budged.
Nope, it really hasn't. And that tells us, in large part, what we thought all along, that this is very much a base election. This is about the basis of the parties. And we're seeing, particularly with independents, that there is a lower motivation to vote. The independents are disgusted with both sides of this conversation. And so that becomes that much more pressing that each side of the aisle gets their base out to vote in this election.
People talk about the margin of error in polls. Where does 4.5 points fall within any margin of error you might be trying to consider?
Well, when you're looking at a 4.5-point race, then the margin of error is plus or minus 4% typically. That means it could be a toss-up, but we've seen consistency in these numbers. So that tells us that, we're looking at what we have a sense of what we know here. And that's probably, in Michigan, an advantage to the Democrats. That's typical of Michigan in election year. And I think what really is going to be interesting to watch is how are both sides doing in getting their bases out? Because that's going to tell the story here. And that should tell the story of Michigan in any competitive election.
When you watch news coverage that involves polling, I'm curious as a pollster how you follow the horse race coverage and the extent to which, maybe like a lot of people, do you think it's overdone? Do you think we focus too much on the polling numbers in our news coverage?
Actually, I do think we focus too much on the polling. I always feel that polling should be used in these races. Public polling should be used to inform the story. Why people are making the decisions they're making. And we should spend less time on the horse race. Let the voters decide the horse race. That's their job. Our job in public polling, I feel, is to just understand the dynamics occurring. That's the most important part. As a pollster, I watch the polls. I also separate the good ones from the bad ones. And I have to say, there are a lot of bad ones out there. Polling has become expensive because of cell phones. And a lot of people in the media don't have the resources to do the good polling that's required. And that requires a hefty cell phone sample, which is far more expensive to reach in polling. So, you know, one of the problems we see, people become disgruntled with the polls. They say, oh, the polling's bad. And they're right. Some of it's really bad because some of it's cheap, frankly.
Since you've brought up how polling is done, I wanted to dig into that a little bit with you, the details of your own polling strategy. How do you reach people? How do you find them? How are they selected? How are they weighted? And do you return to the same people like we see in some polls?
What we do is a random sample drawn from lists of people. Michigan is unique in that approximately 97% of the state is registered to vote. You get your driver's license, you register to vote, and you're on the list. And that's where we start. And then we winnow it down based on your likelihood to vote. And we actually screen people for how likely they are to vote. We ask them, are you definitely voting? Are you probably voting? And when they start to say, especially at this stage, when they say, oh, I'm probably not voting or I'm not voting, well, we screen them out. Because if you're telling us you're probably not voting at this stage, you're not voting. We know that. The hard part for us is getting people to actually respond on the phone. And that's become an increasingly big challenge with cell phones. Cell phones have to be part of a sample now. They have to be. You cannot reach voters, frankly, 35 and younger on a landline anymore. And the ones you do are not necessarily representative of those on a cell phone. So that's why we are very, very careful to make sure that when we do public polling that we have a substantial cell phone sample involved. That's where you get many of the people under 40 years of age responding to you. And, you know, one of the things I started in polling back in the 1980s when everything was a landline, but there were no computers. So you were hand-dialing telephones, and it was slow and tedious. Well, now, you know, for pollsters now, it's kind of back to the past. We were able to computer dial landlines, and now we can't do that with cell phones because it's not legally allowed to computer dial a cell phone. So we are hand-dialing cell phones again. So we're right back where we started. And it's slow and laborious and expensive to do.
We're talking with Richard Chuba. He's the owner of the Glengariff Group, and he does polling for the Detroit News. In the past, he has worked for people like John Engler in Michigan politics. You have brought up public polling, and I want to make a distinction between public polling and what I guess you might say is private polling or for one of the races or a partisan employer like one of the parties. What are they looking for when they hire a pollster, and how do they get what they're looking for?
One of the things that we find, we believe is extraordinarily important is it's got to be played down the center. You can't be choosing sides. Public polling has an extraordinary influence on the narrative of a race. And if you start trying to tip the scale of the numbers, you're going to tip the race. And that's, you know, the media particularly, I think, has to be very sensitive to the influence of that polling. We talked earlier about, are we paying too much attention to the poll? You know, and I think yes. And I think part of it is for this reason. I don't think it's the media's responsibility to tip the narrative of races with polling. And we all know everybody loves a horse race. But we need to be careful that we're focusing on the issues involved in the race and not just the numbers in the race. When you're looking at, you know, pollsters and what campaigns are looking for, I think they're looking, you know, it's a whole different conversation you're having. Because what you're looking for there is a pollster who's going to deliver a strategy for how to get to 50% of the vote plus one to you. You're very much looking for the strategist in that conversation. That's not the public polling part of this.
You've done some private polling, so you know a lot about it, I gather. the part of the question I'm trying to get at is, what are they looking for when, say, a campaign hires a pollster? Do they want, in some cases, to look like they're behind because they're hoping it will encourage the get-out-the-vote effort? Are there campaigns where they hope to look like they're ahead because they're hoping that will encourage their base? Are there advantages one way or the other? Or are they trying to get numbers that tell the story they want to tell?
Well, I can honestly say I have never in 32 years been involved with a campaign that wanted polling numbers to look lower than they were.
Okay.
That's never been the case at all. But I do think there, as we get closer, particularly in the final week of a campaign, you start to, it's silly season, as we say in politics, and you start to see numbers get thrown around just aren't accurate. And people are trying to do things with that. For example, if the race isn't as, you can see numbers that come out where the race just isn't as close as the numbers are claiming. And sometimes that's done to help generate excitement on the losing side's base. Or you see the winning side put out numbers bigger than the race really is to try and show a sense of confidence. So that's why, as we get closer to the election, you really have to be careful about who's behind these numbers. Frankly, where have they been paid for? What are the affiliations of the people paying for that poll? And one of the big questions I always have as a pollster is, what's the methodology? Because, you look at a race like in Michigan right now in the presidential race, and one way to influence the numbers, frankly, is the percentage of the African-American vote included in the survey. Because if it's not accurate, which in Michigan it should be 12 to 14%, then that shows a closer race for the Republicans than it will likely be. And we saw that in 2012, where a lot of polls were showing a closer race in Michigan, probably 5 or 6 points. And we saw a surge in the African-American vote to 16% on Election Day. And that suddenly rose Obama's numbers to 9.5%. In Michigan, I think that African-American block of voters is an essential part of the conversation for what the race really looks like.
I have another question for you about private polling, and that is, since you're involved in public polling now for the Detroit News, do you hear about private polling results? And if so, are they coming up with numbers that are different one way or the other from what you're seeing for the Detroit News?
I think there's, frankly, some consistency that from what we're hearing within the community, what we're seeing, the conversations being had within political circles. We've seen the numbers close in Michigan. We've seen it become tighter back to that May level. That's kind of predictable for the end of a race. Races tend to close unless something happens that just blows it wide open. In this case, it's closed, it's tightened. I think what we're seeing, and you can see it with the Republican activity specifically over in West Michigan, they're trying to enthuse their base. You have Hillary Clinton coming back in Michigan the final weekend. She's trying to enthuse her African-American base. That tells me this race is where we think it is. It's a slight advantage to the Democrats in Michigan. And at this stage, it's all about who can turn out their voters.
I have one final question for you. We've only talked about what would appear to be the presidential race in Michigan. What else are you looking at?
Well, with the Detroit News, we have focused largely on the presidential race this year. With some of our other work, we have looked at the state house races. One of the more fascinating races, frankly, in Michigan is the Macomb County Public Works Commissioner race between Candace Miller and Anthony Baracco. I think it is one of the most hard-fought races we've seen in Michigan in quite some time. It's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out, although Trump is doing well in Macomb County. And I think that is an advantage for Candace Miller in that race. And then I think, in Southeast Michigan, you have the Regional Transit Authority vote. And that's a really interesting policy race. Do voters believe that Southeast Michigan needs better public transit. And I think for years we've seen that being the case where voters do believe that. Will they finally solve the problem in Southeast Michigan? Just from a, you know, a policy perspective, that's a fascinating race.
Richard Chuba is owner of Glengariff Group. He does polling for the Detroit News. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And coming up on Current State, more than 2 years have passed since 43 young adults were abducted and disappeared in southwest Mexico. Two family members connected to the incident, which involved drug gangs and authorities thought to be corrupt, visit Michigan State University today. We'll learn about their visit and problems facing Mexico with an MSU professor and a graduate student from Mexico who have studied the country's problems and who are hosting the family members. That's coming up on Current State. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Religion, politics, race, issues that have been discussed and debated since the beginning of our country. They're still being discussed today. An original play called Disgrace, written by Ayad Akhtar, involves a diverse group of characters discussing these issues over dinner. The play won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 2013. Lansing's Peppermint Creek Theater is running their own production of Disgraced right now. Here to tell us more is the play's director, Gabe Francisco, along with two cast members, Sarah Lynn and Zuab Razak. Gabe, Sarah, Zuab, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Gabe, tell us a little more about the play. What can you share with us about this plot here?
This is a really... it's not the most happiest of plays at the end. This is a really deep, you know, play. This tackles a lot of what it means to be Muslim in a post-9/11 world, and how different cultures and different people in the United States right now kind of deal with that. We have four actors in this show. One is a Jewish curator of the Whitney. One is a WASP, who's an artist, and then... one is a Muslim lawyer, and the other one is an African-American lawyer. And so they all kind of bring their personal, like, backgrounds to this story.
Sounds like it taps into the American zeitgeist of the moment, Zuab, you play Amir. Tell us about this character. You got quite an interesting character to play here.
So I am Muslim in real life, and I'm very proud of that fact, especially in, you know, the time that we live in now. The way that I was brought up, I was taught that Islam is ultimately about peace and acceptance. And so playing this character who has sort of gone to the opposite end of that and doesn't really accept those things about Islam, that was sort of difficult. But ultimately, I think that this show is so important because it does discuss a lot of things that I think Muslims don't necessarily feel like they can talk about, and it gives a voice to that. So
you play Amir Kapoor.
Yes.
This is a successful Pakistani-American lawyer rapidly moving up the corporate ladder. Tell us, go a little bit deeper with us on Amir's attitude toward Islam.
He doesn't really like it. He's renounced his faith.
He's become westernized.
Yeah,
then.
In
is
a
that
way,
what you're
he
saying?
Has. Okay. Yeah. He doesn't really believe in Islam anymore. He thinks of it as a sort of backwards way of thinking and being.
Mm-hmm.
That was literally a line from the show. But
what do you enjoy playing about? It sounds like a complicated role to get into. What do you like about this?
I'm not going to lie, I was like, what the hell did I get myself into? But then as I've sort of worked on the character, I've come to realize why he thinks the way he does. Because there's a line in the show where he says, and I'm saying it's wrong and that it comes from someplace. So I think that his biggest issue is that he is unable to sort of communicate what he feels. And so I think that's why everything happens the way that it does. But
Sarah, you play Emily. Who is Emily? And tell us about her.
Emily is married to Amir. She plays a artist who has become fascinated with not only the Muslim faith, but Muslim art, Islamic art. And so her role in this is kind of an opposite to Amir in the fact that here she is embracing everything that he has renounced of himself.
Mm, how interesting.
Finding that peace.
Going in, kind of in opposite directions. Correct. Then. Is that it? We are talking with Sarah Lynn and Zouab Razak, performers, cast members of the play Disgraced, a production of the Peppermint Creek Theater this week. Also, Gabe Francisco joins us, the director. What's it been like portraying Emily?
It has been definitely a ride. I feel very strongly about a lot of the points and issues that are raised, not only by Emily, but throughout this play. When I was younger, I lived in Jordan for a year. And from there, it kind of stemmed this love and appreciation for different cultures and very specifically for not only the Islamic culture, but the culture in the Middle East. And so to be able to play Emily and her appreciation has been fun. Of course, every character has their own flaws. So having those flaws come to light was something to definitely admire as well.
Gabe, why did Peppermint Creek want to pursue this play?
So this play, actually, I submitted it to Chad Badger, the artistic director, and he asked me just to come to him with a list of shows that were really important to me. And this show is incredibly important to me. I actually went through a pretty serious issue at my university that I went to. I had a young Muslim student come up to me, and I was in the student government, and he just asked me for a place to pray, like they needed a place to pray every day, and they were reserving the same room in a student union building. And he asked me if, you know, we could just make that a permanent hold because, you know, we're going to be praying there every day. And I thought it was the most simplest request, you know, and the Christian kids had a church on campus, you know, I could give these guys a room to pray in themselves. And when I brought this to the student government of my university, they really did not respond how I thought they were going to respond. The backlash that came out of it was not only from the university, from the students of the university, but also it got word out in the local newspaper that I was trying to do this. And they wrote to me back, community members were like, you know, if we give them a room, Islam breeds terrorism. Like, what are we doing? Like, why don't we just hang a sign that says Taliban are welcome? And to me, it just made my fight even more powerful. Like, I had more, like, at first it was just get these guys a room to pray in. But then it was like, this is an equal rights thing now. And so...
And now you're doing this play.
And now I'm doing this play.
Wow.
And so it's all been kind of this domino effect of kind of some experiences I've gone through. And Amir in this story actually kind of goes through one of these. He represents an imam of a local mosque that Emily gets him to talk to because his character is Muslim. And because of that is a domino effect. He ends up getting in a lot of hot water at his work and a lot of hot water at the dinner party that ensues after with Jory, one of his coworkers. And it's just kind of this domino effect.
Would any of you say that Disgraced has a particular takeaway, a particular message, or does it just present the messy reality of our times?
I think from the audience's reaction, consistently, I think it's been that it will make you think a lot. Mm-hmm. And I've heard from many audience members leaving the theater that, you know, I have a lot to think about now.
Yeah. It does not, so you would say, it does not aspire to give answers.
This play definitely asks more questions.
It aspires to provoke questions.
Yes. The thing that I feel that this play definitely you can take away from is there are a lot of issues raised, and we want you to feel uncomfortable about these issues that are raised. It so very clearly reflects the now, what is happening today, and brings issues to those lights, such as privilege, such as race, how you identify yourself. We're living in a time where each and every single one of these characters is being targeted in a different way. Isaac plays a white, he plays a Jewish man, and they're being targeted just now. Amir is a man who has renounced his Muslim faith, who, again, is another group that is being targeted now. Jory is not only a woman, but she's African-American, another target. And Emily, as a woman in America, again, another target. But it definitely not only brings issues to those, or brings light to those issues that are so prevalent in everyday America, but makes you think.
We're just about out of time. Remind our listeners where the play is being presented and where to get tickets.
It's at Peppermint Creek Theater, which is on the south side of Lansing, and you can get tickets at peppermintcreek.org.
Very good.
Yeah.
Everything you need to know. All wrapped up with a bow there. We want to thank Gabe Francisco, director of Disgraced at Peppermint Creek Theater, also cast members on the play, Sarah Lynn and Zuab Razak. Good luck to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, Matthew Stafford has done it again. The Lions quarterback, last-minute heroics yesterday against the Minnesota Vikings, notched another Lions win. We'll find out how he was able to pull another rabbit out of the hat with Current Sports. Al Martin coming up on Current State. Current State, three times daily on WKAR 9 and 6 on 90.5 FM and every day at noon on AM 870 WKAR.
On September 26, 2014, more than 50 students from the Ayotzinapa School for Teachers in Mexico got on a couple of buses. They were headed to the country's capital to join a protest that weekend. 43 of those students disappeared. They were taken at gunpoint after the buses they were riding on were stopped.
For the 43 kidnapped students in Mexico who are
students in Mexico, keep the pressure on the government.
Ayotzinapa are in their late teens or early 20s.
That is part of NPR's Latino USA recent two-year anniversary coverage of the Ayotzinapa tragedy. An inquiry by the Mexican government claimed corrupt local authorities were responsible. It determined that local police, possibly at the order of the local mayor, turned the students over to a drug gang, which massacred them. But many family members of victims don't believe all the government's account. They point to an impartial panel of Latin American investigators, which also disagreed with the findings and said the investigation should continue. Meanwhile, some family members cling to hope that their children are still alive. Two such family members, both fathers of boys impacted by the kidnapping, visit Michigan State University today. One father's son is unaccounted for, still missing. The other's son barely escaped. Some of these family members have toured parts of the United States to tell their story and plead for help. Here to talk about what happened to the students and what's happening today as well. Two guests participating in today's MSU events. Miguel Cabañas is professor of MSU of Romance and Classical Studies at Michigan State University. Welcome back, Miguel.
Oh, thank you.
And Jose Badillo is an MSU graduate student from Mexico who's writing his doctoral dissertation on corruption in his native country. Welcome, Jose.
Thank you.
The two fathers, Mr. De La Cruz and Mr. Contreras, are visiting East Lansing as part of an ongoing tour called Caravana 43. What is Caravana 43? What's it trying to accomplish?
Caravana 43 started in the spring of 2015, and they came to the United States to bring attention to the issue of Ayotzinapa and the lack of justice perpetrated in Mexico. So they came to get the support of the Mexican community and also to get the attention of the U.S. Authorities to help them to pressure the Mexican government to continue the investigation that they closed very, very rapidly without really attaining a good end to the investigation. So they came last year to MSU. They were here, and this year they're coming back again because nothing has changed. They haven't found their kids, and there's still 43 people and even more people in Guerrero still missing.
What can you tell us about these your visitors' sons? We know that that Mr. Contreras' son was abducted and disappeared. Mr. De La Cruz's son was more fortunate. What happened to him?
He actually, his story is remarkable. He has pictures of what happened. He saw his mates fallen by the bullets of the police. And he actually, he's still very much depressed, psychologically depressing. As he says, he feels like he's dead, that, that nothing can happen to him until he finds his friends.
Jose Badillo, as a MSU graduate student who grew up in Mexico, give us your perspective on what we've talked about so far here, and what happened with these Ayotzinapa students?
Well, it's hard to tell exactly what happened to the students. We know that they disappeared and that the authorities were involved, but it's difficult to find their whereabouts. It's so difficult to uncover all this when you have local authorities, state, federal police, the army, when they're all involved, and it's hard, it's just difficult to find an answer when there's so much corruption behind it.
Mm. And it's hard to generalize, I'm sure, because we're talking about 43 different families who've been jarred by this tragedy. But have most parents abandoned hope that they will see their kids again, or do some think that they will?
I think they still have hope. They're still hoping to find their children alive. And that's what they say. They took him alive, give him back to us alive.
I think so too. Part of this, the caravana, it's a process that's not ending. They're not going to stop until they, find their sons, or until they find, their bodies. There's no closure until, they know what happened to their sons.
You've both studied this abduction and disappearance and the ensuing investigations and all the disagreements involved in this. What do you think happened, Miguel?
I think, it's clear that the investigation by the Justice Department in Mexico was flawed. And, the experts from other parts of Latin America have found that incorrect. And, there's also a clear thing that happened that we know now that the military knew about it. They were watching the whole thing happened, and they didn't do anything about it. It's not clear. Obviously, we can't know what happened until there's a full investigation. But we know that the findings by the government panel were not correct, because the military knew about it. They were just watching. They didn't, help the civilians. And also, there's new reports that the federal police was involved, and therefore, the investigation is totally flawed. It wasn't a local job. It was a collusion between the authorities and the drug gangs.
You referred to a government panel, though. This is actually, let's clarify here, wasn't that an international panel that was brought in to analyze the government's report on what happened?
Right. That's the experts. But, the government itself, they actually put up a report, right, that contradicts that. And so, basically they said, the military was not involved. They had nothing. You can't ask them questions. So they buried the whole investigation under the premise that, the military is not corrupt. We can't ask them questions. The police, the federal police was not involved. And therefore, you have to stop the investigation. And that tells me that there's, something buried, and there is a larger corruption and collusion story that needs to be uncovered.
I'm talking with MSU professor Miguel Cabañas and MSU student Jose Badillo, who is a native of Mexico. We're talking about problems in that country with drugs, gangs, and official corruption. Two others, parents of kids, involved in the 2014 kidnapping of 43 young adults attending the Ayotzinapa school. Those parents are visiting Michigan State today and will share their stories and discuss these problems creating strife in that country. Jose, you grew up in Mexico. Were you or your family able to witness the kind of corruption here that we're talking about here, or was it off your radar?
Growing up in Mexico, it becomes something normal. It becomes something that you live with. Going to the store, driving, you get pulled over by the police, and if you don't want any problems, taking your car to the junkyard or going to the police station, you just give them, $50, $50, mm-hmm. The gangs, they were also, at least in the neighborhood where I grew up, the gangs were, they work in collaboration with the police. They would stop by and, they would like shake hands like, they know each mm-hmm. other, like they knew each other, and they would walk away. I mean, I grew up with it, and I was always told, just look away, don't say anything, mm-hmm. and you'll stay out of trouble.
What part of the country did you grow up in?
I grew up in Guadalajara. So Guadalajara is about 7 or 8 hours from Ayotzinapa.
The reason I ask is that I'm led to believe by reports that I've heard on NPR and other sources that there are parts of the country that are more susceptible to violence and corruption, and there are other parts of the country that are relatively free from this kind of thing. Is that the case, Jose, as you see it?
I think it used to be. It used to be more, on the borders, because that's where, the drug travels,
right.
The coast, all the ports. But now you see it, everywhere. You see it, in the main cities, touristic cities. I think Professor Cabañas was talking earlier about how bad it is in Guerrero.
Right. And Guerrero, for example, is very interesting. So the poppy...
Let's make clear. Guerrero is the state in which the Ayotzinapa school is. It's in the southwestern part of the country.
That is correct. And there's a lot of indigenous communities there. In Guerrero has developed the poppy seed production, and so they've been creating this heroin production as the U.S. was, using more heroin, and and the marijuana was becoming more legal and available. Heroin has become the new source of big income, right? So some experts say that it's about $17 billion of the profits that area of Guerrero are getting from the heroin production.
$17 billion just from
yes.
that part of one state in Mexico.
Yeah, and so that could be closer to $30 billion, right? So these are just estimates, but $17 billion.
We're just about out of time. Can the public attend any of the gatherings at MSU today?
Yes, they can. We have a big event. And we're going to review what happened in Ayotzinapa at 2:30 to 4:30, so they can come. It's a computer center, 402. And, everybody's invited. It's free for everybody. It will have a panel of experts talk after a video. And then we'll talk to the parents who know exactly what's happening, what has been happening in the last year in Ayotzinapa, and their, the whole thing, how they is developed in Mexico, how what the strides they're trying to accomplish, new things, and how the movement is doing.
Again, two fathers of young men who attended the Ayotzinapa Teachers Education School in Iguala, Mexico. both of whom were impacted. One's son is still missing. The others miraculously escaped. They will be at 402 Computer Center, 2:30 this afternoon at Michigan State University. We want to thank MSU professor Miguel Cabañas and MSU graduate student Jose Badillo. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Detroit Lions are a game over 500 and sit in second place in the NFC North. Still in the top spot, the Minnesota Vikings enduring heartbreak at the hands of the Honolulu Blue and Silver yesterday afternoon. Matthew Stafford led the team downfield for yet another game-winning drive in overtime. No less, Current Sports Al Martin joins us now to talk about the magic of the Lions and how long it might last. Hi, Al.
How about four of the last five, Mark? Is that right in the script? Is that, my goodness.
This is grabbing a lot of people's attention, and the way they're winning even more so. What transpired in those last couple of minutes that allowed the Lions to win this thing?
Well, let's just go back to 23 seconds left in regulation. This team needs to have, at the very least, a field goal to try and push it to overtime to give themselves a chance to win, right? Matthew Stafford, you can't give this dude 23 seconds. Heck, you can't even give him 1 second now. I mean, when you look at what he's done this year, it's been truly remarkable, Mark. So 23 seconds on the clock. Matthew Stafford finds Golden Tate to the sidelines. Golden Tate goes out of bounds, stops the clock. Andre Roberts this time. Matthew Stafford, I thought in that moment the Lions needed at least 24. They end up getting 27 yards due to the completion from Stafford to Andre Roberts. And then this was so key to me, Mark. For Matthew Stafford and that Detroit Lions offense to understand the situation that, okay, we had 23 to start this drive. We need to clock the football. They rush to the line of scrimmage. They all get in a legal formation. Matthew Stafford hikes it, spikes it. 2 seconds left. That took a lot of heads-up play from all 11 men in the Honolulu Blue. And then Matthew Prater goes out, kicks a 58-yard field goal. That's good. That ties the game. And we look at Matt Prater, Mark. I mean, talk about clutch. Not only just Matthew Stafford here in this conversation, but Matt Prater is now 23 of 23 when it comes to fourth quarter or overtime go-ahead field goal wins or to tie the game. I mean, it's unbelievable. He's never missed 23 of 23.
And he's so good from so far out. He holds
exactly.
The NFL record for the longest. And yesterday's was 58 yards or whatever it was. A lot of kickers would not have made that.
And we were talking before I just came in here. I mean, that thing would have been good from 62, maybe. It really has some loft on it. And then, of course, to culminate, you know, that game for the Lions, Stafford to Golden Tate. The king of yak yards after catch, right? Stops on a dime near the sidelines, eludes one tackle, and does like a Simone Biles USA Gymnastics flip to seal the deal for the Lions. I mean, how you can't write this stuff up being any better, can you, Mark?
That was something else. How, I mean, these thrilling endings are great when you win. How can the Lions take control of games earlier, assert themselves more strongly at the start of these matchups and stay in control?
Well, that's a good question.
Just not in the
right.
team's DNA or what?
Exactly. Well, and I will say this, though. When you win close games like this, and this is again, the fifth time out of the five wins the Lions have had this year, I mean, Matthew Stafford has led his team to a game-winning drive, right? I mean, it's really a remarkable stat when you look at it. But, yeah, you would like that comfort of having some cushion in these games, right? I mean, win one where you don't have to pull off some last-second heroics. But with that being said, Mark, when you win games like that, it does a lot for your confidence moving forward because it doesn't matter what transpired in the first three quarters. You may be down. The Lions still believe they can win that game. From a confidence standpoint, it's great. They sit 5-4 in the year. They're a half game in back of the team they just beat on Sunday. And you look at the rest of the season, Mark. I mean, they play their final three division games at home. That's huge. And that does include the Vikings, who will be trying to feast on the Lions and want some revenge after what took place this past weekend. They play each other on Thanksgiving Day, so that should be a fun game.
Has Matthew Stafford become a part of any MVP conversation?
Without a doubt. Yeah, he's certainly in the mix right now, Mark. I mean, you look at his statistics. I mean, right now he ranks 6th in the NFL in touchdowns. He ranks 4th in the NFL when it comes to passer rating among QBs with over 100 attempts down the field. When you look at, you know, his other numbers, since 2011, no quarterback has had more fourth quarter comebacks. He has 19 on the year thus far. He threw for 219 yards, Mark, 2 touchdowns against a fourth-ranked pass defense against the Vikings. And, hey, he's also in the top 10 in passing yards this season. And, oh, by the way, the Lions sit above 500. Mm. That certainly puts him in that conversation, Mark.
The Michigan State football team taking another loss, this time to Illinois on Saturday, marking 7 straight losses. What are the Spartans playing for now? What do they have to play for now?
Yeah, talk about shifting the mood here on current state, right?
Yeah.
It's been a really tough year, Mark. And you look at the bodies that they've just been beaten up this year, especially when it comes to health, Mark. We saw Tyler O'Connor go out with a concussion test this past weekend. Malik McDowell, foot injury. Vyontae Copeland, it was announced yesterday that he is now out for the season with a broken foot. Monte Nicholson, Kari Willis, we didn't see them play Saturday. We saw offensive lineman David Beadle go out. It's tough when you don't have the bodies, and you couple that with youth, nothing is guaranteed. No win is guaranteed for this MSU football team. There's 3 games left. Rutgers, Ohio State, both at home. Then they finish on the road against Penn State. At this point, Mark, you just want to get better. You just want to get better. Wins and losses aside here, this team needs to just get better. No guarantees in the win column, though.
Michigan rolled over the Terrapins this weekend at Maryland. Do you see the Wolverines finishing undefeated with 3 left to go?
Well, I'll tell you what. All signs point to just one heck of a showdown between the Wolverines and the Ohio State Buckeyes come November 26th. I do believe that both of these teams will be undefeated when they meet in that season finale. And I really do believe that Ohio State has a legit shot to try and knock off the Wolverines and give them their very first loss of the year. I think that it's been a remarkable year for the Wolverines, without a doubt, Mark. They're one of the best teams in the nation. But I still think when you compare their schedule with other stout teams in that top 10 ranking right now, I still think that the schedule has been a bit soft for the Wolverines. I haven't really seen them be truly tested on the road. And I really believe that Ohio State is going to bring it on that day.
Can't wait for the Ohio State game.
Certainly.
I'm a Spartan. Don't get me wrong, but that's a hell of a matchup, and
yep,
it'll be really intense this year.
Certainly.
One of the positives from the Michigan State sporting weekend was men's soccer. We beat Penn State in the Big Ten tournament. How significant is this for Damon Rensing and his team?
This is huge, and we'll actually have Damon on Current Sports later this afternoon live here in studio to talk about it. But, you know, for this program to host its very first ever Big Ten tournament game, I mean, that's huge. That's huge. And, you know, this is a Michigan State team, Mark, that didn't lose and hasn't still lost at home all season. Absolutely remarkable. So they host that game. They play Penn State. They get that 2-1 win. It was a great play, a great header from Jimmy Fiskus to give them the go-ahead dub with, you know, that still came, though, with 15 minutes left. Huge play, though. And now they move on to play Maryland on Friday in Indiana. Maryland actually topped Michigan over the weekend. But this is huge for this program, and I'm excited, you know, how this sets them up for a possible NCAA tourney berth moving forward.
We got less than a minute, Al, but which local teams are still alive in high school football after 2 playoffs?
Yes, just week to rattle 2. Off a few. Yeah, going into week 3 now, we've got DeWitt in Division 3, Corunna still alive in Division 4, the Ithaca Yellow Jackets. I feel like I'm saying their name every single year during this time of the year, Mark. They're still alive in D5 this time. They moved up from D6. Jackson Lumen Christi at D6 and Pawamo Westphalia at D7. Exciting times, Mark.
More from Al Martin this afternoon at 1 on AM 870 WKAR. It's Current Sports. Thank you, Al.
Hey, anytime, Mark. Thank you.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow morning at 9, it's a special encore edition of Current State. Then, we want to remind you to join us tomorrow night starting at 8 for our special live coverage of Election 2016. WKAR News, our Current State personnel, and the MSU School of Journalism are joining forces to provide the state's largest election team coverage That officially starts at 8 o'clock tomorrow night, just as the polls close. We'll bring you results of all the state and local races, issues affecting first-time voters, plus comprehensive national coverage from NPR. That's our live election night coverage starting at 8 tomorrow night on 90.5 FM, Twitter, Facebook, and WKAR.org. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to engineer Drew Hill. All that we create ends up on the Current State podcast. You can pick that up anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. With tomorrow night happening, we want to remind you of where to connect with us on Twitter. Stay connected with us at KAR Current State. On Facebook, we're at Current State from WKAR, and it all ends up at WKAR.org as well. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. See you tomorrow night at 8 for special live coverage of Election 2016. See you then.